From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Tomorrow, the Illinois Supreme Court will hear the last case of its May term, and it saved one of the biggest for last. It involves the state's recent ban on assault weapons, or at least the new manufacture, sale, purchase, and possession of assault weapons, as well as large-capacity magazines. Almost as quickly as Governor J.B. Pritzker signed the ban into law earlier this year, gun rights advocates challenged it in state and federal court. One of those cases is being led by Republican State Representative Dan Calkins of Decatur. In March, Macon County Circuit Court Judge Rodney Forbes ruled in that case that exceptions in the ban violated multiple clauses in the Illinois state constitution. Attorney General Kwame Raoul appealed the case directly to the state Supreme Court, and the justices agreed to take it on. Joining us now to talk about what we can expect in tomorrow's hearing is Peter Hancock, Statehouse reporter for Capital News Illinois. Peter, welcome back to the 21st Show.
Thanks, Brian.
Also with us is Jason Mazzoni. He is a professor of law at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and director of the Illinois Program in Constitutional Theory, History, and Law. Jason, welcome back to you as well. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. Good to be here.
And last but certainly not least, David Franklin teaches constitutional law at DePaul in Chicago. He was also Solicitor General of Illinois, basically the state's top appellate lawyer from 2016 to 2019. David, welcome back to you, and thank you for being here.
Good morning, Brian. Good to be here.
And listeners, as ever, you can join our conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. What do you think about Illinois' assault weapons ban, and what questions do you have about the legal cases against it? The number again, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. All right, Peter, can you sketch the history of this law, maybe starting from Independence Day last year through the governor signing it in January?
Yeah, sure. So this began with the Independence Day, the mass shooting in Highland Park on 4th of July last year. In response to that, the Illinois General Assembly came in during a special lame duck session in January of this year to pass this assault weapons ban. We also saw a local ordinance in the city of Naperville that passed, I think, in August or September of last year. And so they're being challenged across the board in both state and federal court. This one, there were a handful of lawsuits in state court. The one that the Supreme Court will hear tomorrow was filed by State Representative Dan Calkins, and it was heard in Macon County, which is the Decatur area. And essentially, the question here is whether or not those exceptions that you were talking about, who can own assault weapons and who cannot, violate the Due Process Clause and what's known as the Special Legislation Clause of the Illinois Constitution.
The special We do call it an assault weapons ban, but there are a lot of nuances and exceptions. Can you talk about what some of those exceptions are?
Yeah, sure. It has to do with who can and can't own these weapons and large capacity magazines. For instance, active and retired law enforcement are allowed to have the weapons. Employees of state prisons, active duty military, but not retired military. And so the allegation here is that those exceptions are kind of arbitrary and inconsistent, and therefore they deprive other people of their constitutional rights.
All right, so we're going to come to some of these specific Illinois questions here, but maybe it's worth just thinking broadly about the Second Amendment. And I guess, Jason Mazzoni, I'm going to ask you to just broadly speaking, what rights are conferred by the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution?
Sure. So the language of the Second Amendment is quite short, but it contains two main provisions, and most of the longstanding debate over the Second Amendment has been the relationship between those two things. So the Second Amendment says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. That's the first provision. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, for a long time, many people thought that there was a tight connection between this initial reference to the militia and the right that is protected, so that the right was one that was limited to the context of militia service. In a 2008 case called District of Columbia versus Heller, the Supreme Court, in an opinion by Justice Scalia, rejected that idea that the right protected by the Second Amendment is one that only exists in the context of militia service, and that the Second Amendment right of the people to keep and bear arms is also an individual right separate from any sort of involvement in the militia, and that individual right at its core is a right of individual self-defense. The issue in Heller was whether District of Columbia could prohibit completely possession of operable firearms, handguns at home for the purposes of self-defense. And under the reading that the majority of the court in Heller adopted, the court said that that outright wholesale ban on handguns at home for self-defense was invalid, inconsistent with this individual right of self-defense. And so that's really the starting point for where we are today. If Heller had come out differently, we wouldn't be talking about the constitutionality of this Illinois law. Heller gave rise to a whole series of cases asking, well, outside of the context of the home and handguns, what kinds of other sorts of individual rights and individual protections are conferred by the Second Amendment? And that's given rise to a huge amount of litigation, including the case that the Illinois Supreme Court will hear tomorrow.
Yeah, and maybe David Franklin, you can pick up the baton there and talk about some of those additional cases that have come up in the years since this individual right to bear arms was established.
Well, I think the most important one was just last year. The Supreme Court struck down New York's concealed carry law, and the court established a new rule. And the new rule works like this. The court said, if there's a law that regulates the right to keep and bear arms as those words were understood when the Constitution was first ratified, then the law is basically presumed to be unconstitutional unless the state can come into court and prove that there's a long-standing American tradition of imposing similar regulations. So what that means is that to defend a piece of gun control legislation in court, a state is going to have to draw some sort of analogy between its current law and some unspecified pattern of laws from unspecified periods in the past, maybe the late 18th century, maybe the mid 19th century, who knows? The court wasn't clear about that. And I'll just lay my cards on the table and say, I think this is an absurd and dangerous way to do constitutional law. And the federal court decision just last month striking down the Illinois assault weapons ban, I think proves how absurd it is. So the judge in that case did several things that I would call into question, but crucially what he said was, there's no pattern of analogous regulations, you know, from the era of the founding that are comparable to an assault weapons prohibition. Well, of course there isn't. You know, an individual who is armed with an assault weapon is a one-person killing machine. The founding fathers didn't have that kind of problem to deal with. And so the Supreme Court's so-called originalist methodology really makes it difficult for states to, you know, respond to changes in technology, even when they pose a real threat to public safety. And I'll just add, finally, I think the framers of the Constitution, who were themselves practical problem solvers, would be appalled at this approach to constitutional interpretation. But that's where we are.
Yes, they didn't have large capacity magazines. I guess a large capacity magazine at the time of a founding would have been maybe a two-shot pistol as opposed to a one-shot. Let's come back to the federal case here. I want to stick with the Illinois Supreme Court case for now. And Peter, maybe you can just, I cut you off earlier, but talk about some of the specific objections that the gun rights advocates were raising before the Illinois Supreme Court here.
Well, they were talking about the fact that some people are allowed to own weapons and other people are not. And they've also been complaining about the process by which this bill went through the General Assembly. The original title of this bill said it has to do with the insurance code and public adjusters. Essentially, it was what's called a gut and replace. There was a bill. They just stripped out all the contents, put in the contents of a new bill, so that that first bill had been read three times. It went through one chamber, came over to the Senate. It was read in twice. Then they did the gut and replace. So they're saying that the bill didn't really have three readings in both chambers, which is also required by the Constitution. The court, I believe the court actually rejected that one. The Macon County Court rejected that one. But there has been a lot of criticism of the legislature over the kind of, it seems like for every rule in the Constitution, they've come up with a way to get around it. So those are some of the objections.
Sure.
But more generally, just the idea that they're telling people what kind of guns they can and can't have. And they don't think the state has that authority.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, that's right. I don't know that we need to spend too much time on the three readings and the single subject clause arguments, because those are things that often get brought up in the Illinois context. I don't know if David Franklin, you want to mention that, if you had cases come up like that when you were Solicitor General. The courts don't usually look too favorably upon those arguments, at least not.
No, I think that's right. We certainly did, and it's often what lawyers call a make weight argument. You sort of throw it in. Because you're basically arguing that there was some impurity in the way that the sausage was made. But the Illinois Supreme Court justices understand that sausage making is messy, and they're not particularly interested, usually anyway, in second guessing that process.
Yeah. All right. So I thought, you know, we do have a couple of constitutional law professors on the show today, so I thought maybe we could actually get a little into the weeds of how some of these Supreme Court cases work. And Jason, maybe I can ask you to delve into this idea of, you know, the gun rights advocates want the court to review their case using what's called strict scrutiny, because they claim that the right to bear arms is a fundamental right. And so I'm going to ask us to go through some of those phrases, but let's start, and I should say, please explain this to me like I'm a smart 13-year-old. But first off, what is meant by a fundamental right?
Well, I don't know that there is a single constitutional definition, but ordinarily a constitutionally protected right, whether you deem it a fundamental right or use some other phrase, might be a provision of the Bill of Rights or an implied right that the court has been willing to recognize, something that is not specifically mentioned in the Constitution, but that the court thinks is protected by the Constitution. That sort of analysis in various kinds of cases has also relied upon tradition and history. But the kind of right that, in sort of simple terms, requires the government, if it's going to regulate, to meet a very high standard, what we would call the strict scrutiny standard. The presumption is that the government regulation is unconstitutional unless the government can meet some very high test. And there's a sort of different formulations of the test, but narrowly tailored to compelling government interests. So the kind of deference that you would give to the government in most areas of government regulation doesn't apply if you're dealing with a right that a court has deemed to be fundamental and deserving of special protection. And so this case before the Illinois Supreme Court, it's a little complicated because as Peter and David had described, and as you had mentioned also, Brian, the way that the state is defending the statute is by saying that what we're talking about here is the classifications that the government, the state has drawn among various kinds of people, because the statute does include a set of exemptions for people who possess these kinds of firearms before the law took effect, exceptions for, I think it's seven classes of police officers and security officers and so on. So those kinds of distinctions, whenever the government draws any kind of distinction, there's potentially an equality problem, an equal protection problem, and so on. The state the state's defense of the statute. It says, yes, the government is classifying, but for purposes of the equal protection provision of the Illinois Constitution, if you think about this law in that way, in terms of the distinctions, that classifications are only subject to very low level review, because they say for purposes of equal protection law, at least, the Second Amendment rights or the analogous right in the Illinois Constitution is not for that purpose a fundamental right. So that's an argument. And if they're right about the framing, then there's a huge amount of deference that is given to the state. I should say that the plaintiffs in the case don't think that this is the only issue before the Illinois Supreme Court tomorrow, or the only way that the court should be thinking about this problem. So in their briefs, the plaintiffs say, mm-hmm. yes, there was this equality issue that was raised and that was ruled on by the circuit court in the case. But we have always pressed a kind of front-on, wholesale Second Amendment argument against this particular statute, quite apart from the distinctions that the statute actually draws among different yeah. groups of people.
Now, all right, I'm going to ask you to pause there because we need to take a break on the show. And when we come back, we're going to continue diving in to the arguments that are going before the Illinois Supreme Court tomorrow, Tuesday, on Illinois' new assault weapons law that was enacted this January. More to come. This is the 21st Show. Do stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about Illinois' new assault weapons law, the ban on the new, at least, manufacture, sale, purchase, and possession of assault weapons and large capacity magazines. It was signed into law earlier this year by Governor J.B. Pritzker. There have been a number of state and federal cases since that time. One of those state cases is coming to oral arguments tomorrow at the Illinois Supreme Court. Other cases are ongoing. But we're talking about this with Peter Hancock, who's a State House reporter for Capital News Illinois, David Franklin, who teaches constitutional law at DePaul in Chicago and was a past Solicitor General of Illinois, basically the top appellate lawyer for the state, and Jason Mazzoni, who's a professor of law at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and director of the Illinois Program in Constitutional Theory, History, and Law. 800-222-9455. If you have a question and want to join our conversation today, that's 800-222-9455. And Jason, I'm sorry, before the break, I had to interrupt you. You were basically making the point that the gun advocates in this case are pressing a more expansive argument than maybe the state
is. So the thing I'll be listening for tomorrow in this argument is whether the Illinois Supreme Court thinks that the job before it is just to ask whether the distinctions that David and Peter had described are themselves constitutional under equal protection requirements, or whether the Supreme Court justices think before them for them to decide is whether the statute as a whole is a restriction on Second Amendment rights, which would bring you into the context of the Bruin decision that David had described earlier. That's a kind of decision point that I think is going to be very important in this case.
I guess, David, what do you think of that?
I do think that the full-on frontal Second Amendment claim that Jason mentioned earlier is probably not one that the Illinois Supreme Court is going to take up. I mean, after all, those kinds of arguments are arguments to be made in federal court. And if that were the plaintiff's theory, then the state could have transferred the case to federal court. Now, the Illinois Constitution does have its own right to keep and bear arms provision. But importantly, that provision is different from the federal one. The Illinois Constitution says that the right to keep and bear arms is subject to the police power, which really means subject to the ability of the state to regulate in the interest of public safety. And so I think at the end of the day, it really comes down to the question that the state thinks is central here, right? Which is, are the exceptions in this law a violation of equal protection principles? And I think the problem with that argument is that the Illinois Supreme Court has already rejected it almost 30 years ago in a very similar case. The court said, when it comes to the right to keep and bear arms, you sort of can't bootstrap yourself into a fundamental rights argument by trying to make an equal protection argument. And I think that makes sense, right? As long as there are rational reasons for thinking that, say, police officers have a greater need to have certain weapons than the general public, or a rational reason to think that, you know, correctional officers are more likely to use these weapons safely, then there is no violation of equality principles because the state is treating relevantly different people differently. The Supreme Court has often said that the state is entitled to attack problems one step at a time. And I think that's exactly what's going on here. You know, the argument that the plaintiffs are trying to make, somewhat ironically, is sort of similar, believe it or not, to the argument against the prohibitions on same-sex marriage. So when the Supreme Court of the United States decided the Obergefell case, striking down those prohibitions, one way of reading the Supreme Court's decision in that case was to say that because marriage is a fundamental right, a state can't tell some people but not others that they're allowed to marry. But the difference here is that the Illinois Constitution tells us that gun ownership isn't that kind of sort of unadorned fundamental right. It is subject to the police power and therefore subject to reasonable classifications.
Interesting. So that's under the state constitution. Is the right to bear arms, though, becoming a fundamental right under the U.S. Constitution, or is that not relevant in what we're talking about today?
Well, so the U.S. Constitution, because it contains a textually enumerated Second Amendment, does declare what the U.S. Supreme Court has called a fundamental right to keep and bear arms. As Jason said, the term fundamental right is somewhat plastic, right? It means different things in different contexts. If you've got a textually enumerated, you know, explicit right, like the Second Amendment, then it's generally considered to be fundamental. And in the Heller case that Jason was describing earlier from 2008, that's exactly what Justice Scalia said on behalf of the Supreme Court. But the question here is whether a right is considered fundamental enough to call into question classifications between people. When I teach constitutional law, I'm just pedantic enough to insist that this kind of thing be called a fundamental interest rather than a fundamental right, just to try to keep the terminology straight, although maybe I confuse my students more than I enlighten them by insisting upon that. But I think the state in this case makes a good case that the right to keep and bear arms under the Illinois Constitution is not a fundamental interest in that sense. That is to say, it doesn't trigger strict scrutiny under equal protection principles. I realize there was a lot of constitutional law lingo, but you wanted to get in the weeds, Brian.
The 13-year-old in me is head is spinning. But I guess, so yeah, if the court, you know, decides that not to use this strict scrutiny, I guess they apply a rational basis test. Maybe we don't have to get into that. Peter, just to briefly say, right, a rational basis means if banning assault weapons is a rational means of furthering public safety. Peter, there are other challenges. We talked a little earlier about the federal court case. Can you just give us an overview of some of the other cases we should be keeping an eye on as we are continuing to follow the future of Illinois' potential ban on assault weapons, I guess, at this point?
Sure. There are, I think, about five of them, actually. And there is some recent news on this, that the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals has agreed to an expedited schedule to hear appeals in all five of these cases at once. We've mentioned one from the Southern District of Illinois, the court in East St. Louis, where a judge issued a temporary restraining order, I think, to block enforcement of the law. But then within a week, the Seventh Circuit put a stay on that injunction. So the law went back into effect. There is now an application for the U.S. Supreme Court. It sits before one justice, Amy Coney Barrett, to put the temporary restraining order back into effect. We haven't heard anything from her, but just on Friday, the state notified her that the Seventh Circuit has agreed to this expedited appeal. And the Seventh Circuit also said it's going to leave the stay in place. So the law is currently being enforced. It's currently in effect, unless Amy Coney Barrett should say otherwise.
You know, and that's interesting because one of our public radio colleagues, Mawa Iqbal, had a piece recently about a firearms dealer in Alton, Illinois, who saw a big spike in sales after that federal court order we were discussing. But then because that was reversed by the federal appellate court, the Seventh Circuit, as you referred to, he said he now has 200 firearms that people purchased but can no longer legally pick up. So there are some real world consequences here.
Yeah, and some lawmakers have talked about that as well. There was apparently a six-day period where it was legal, according to this judge in East St. Louis, it was legal to buy these things. And yeah, there was a spike in sales because people weren't sure how long that was going to stay in effect. And so the question now is, did the people who purchased weapons and have already received them, did they violate the law or not? So I think that'll eventually get worked out. But so, yeah, I mean, there has been some confusion because different courts at different levels have set either, you know, put temporary restraining orders or preliminary injunctions in place to block enforcement, and then a higher court will lift that. So there has been some confusion in some areas.
Interesting. All right. So let me just take a moment to remind listeners, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about Illinois' law banning the new purchase and sale and manufacture and possession of assault weapons, although with many exceptions, such as if you already owned one of these weapons when the law was signed back in January, as well as a number of different categories, such as police officers, security guards at nuclear power plants, military personnel. Some of those groups are entitled to possess these weapons anytime and in their civilian lives, some only within the context of their employment. And we are talking about this with Peter Hancock from Capital News Illinois and two constitutional law professors, Jason Mazzoni from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and David Franklin from DePaul in Chicago. I wonder if we can talk a little bit about one aspect we heard a lot about earlier this year, haven't heard as much lately. Jason Mazzoni, what do you think of this so-called constitutional sheriff's movement, the idea that sheriffs have some special authority under the U.S. Constitution to choose not to enforce these laws?
This is a great issue. So on the one hand, it seems desirable that we would want local police officers not to act in violation of the Constitution, right? That seems like a good thing. I like the idea that local law enforcement officers would be thinking about constitutional restraints on their behavior and seeking to conform their actions vis-a-vis citizens to constitutional requirements. That said, I think they are subject to a check. I think the check is within the state employment system. They have to follow commands from above. And so I think that's really where the check on their behavior comes from. But as a kind of general matter, I mean, maybe you oppose sheriffs refusing to enforce this kind of law on constitutional grounds. But I think there are plenty of other circumstances in which we might think that it's actually a good thing for police officers to think about constitutional restraints on their own conduct.
I suppose, such as with policing protesters or something. David Franklin, do you have a perspective on this constitutional sheriff's movement?
Sheriffs are state actors, and so when they're acting within the scope of their duties, they have to take the orders that are given to them. As individuals, they may have constitutional rights, but when they're acting as state actors, they don't.
Interesting. I wonder what where we see some of the future frontiers in firearms laws, and maybe Jason, I can start with you. Where do you see this? Are there more cases? Because we mentioned goes back to Heller in 2008. There have been this series of cases, including the one out of New York you mentioned last year. What are the next frontiers that you're keeping an eye on in terms of the right to bear arms in America?
Well, I think the most immediate thing is exactly what we're talking about. We are right now in the middle of a process where state courts and lower courts are confronting this really important question of restrictions on particular types of weapons. Heller dealt only with handguns. The U.S. Supreme Court has not, since Heller, dealt with any cases involving other sorts of firearms. There's been lots of litigation around the country on other sorts of firearms, and that's exactly what we have here in Illinois. So we are along the path, I think, to the U.S. Supreme Court in the next couple of years for it to consider, to think about the scope of Second Amendment protections in a context where you have all sorts of state and local bans on semi-automatic rifles and other sorts of weapons. I think that the U.S. Supreme Court within the next couple of years is almost certainly going to hold that at least certain semi-automatic weapons are protected by the Second Amendment, and that's going to have the effect of overturning laws in many many states and cities, and nationalizing that right. So I think that's the most immediate thing, and we are right in the middle of it.
David Franklin, what about you? What are you keeping an eye on in terms of where overall firearms law in the Constitution is going in America?
Oh, well, I think the Supreme Court has basically declared open season and said, you know, plaintiffs out there, you know, gun advocates, we invite you to come to court and to challenge all sorts of laws, you know, laws that say that people who are subject to domestic violence restraining orders can have their guns taken away during the pendency of that proceeding, laws that say that you're not allowed to manufacture your own so-called ghost gun using a 3D printer, laws that govern what counts as a sensitive place where guns can be prohibited, and many, many other types of laws. And in every single one of those cases, courts are going to be required to ask whether there's some analogous regulation from goodness knows the 18th century. So I come back to the point that I started with, Brian. That's an absurd way to do constitutional law, and I think it's dangerous for public safety.
David Franklin is a professor at DePaul College of Law, where he teaches about the Constitution. Jason Mazzoni is a professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and is director of the Illinois Program in Constitutional Theory, History, and Law. Peter Hancock, State House reporter with Capital News Illinois. David, Jason, Peter, thank you all so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for holding the conversation.
Listeners, we would love to hear what you think about what we've been talking about, whether it's today's show or anything in the recent past or even the distant past. Send us an email. talk@21stshow.org is the address, whether you liked it or didn't like it. If you think we got something factually wrong or if you think we got something right, let us know. Again, the email address is talk@21stshow.org. talk@21stshow.org. We'll be sharing some of your responses on air from time to time. You can also find our email address as well as our voicemail line and every other way to contact us on our website, 21stshow.org. More to come after a short break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.